Welcome to Dig, a history podcast. Hey guys, it's Avril. I just wanted to jump in before Elizabeth and Sarah start in on this episode about Dickens, because we want to give a shout out to a reviewer from iTunes, a person named History Nerd 87, posted on September 24th, 2017, top notch, 5 stars. If you're looking for a history podcast that does more than give you some trivia facts, this is it! The lovely ladies at Dig will weave interesting stories for you, but also demonstrate why history matters. It's refreshing to get such an in-depth and thoughtful lesson on a wide range of historical periods. It's clear that these are real historians who know their shit and love what they do. Not to mention, they're fun to listen to. I find myself laughing out loud each episode. Thanks, History Nerd 87, and thank you to all who have rated us and reviewed us on iTunes. We hope that if you haven't yet, you'll jump on, and we'll be sure to give you a shout out at our next episode.
Do y'all know this song? You want to sing with us?
Yeah, I know this.
Okay. Yeah. Everyone knows this song.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. There'll be parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling. Out in the snow, there'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago.
Wait, did this song just say that there will be scary ghost stories?
Why, yes, Sarah. Yes, it did.
I'm sorry, I don't get it.
Well, telling ghost stories at Christmas time is actually a thing. Now, it's not as big a deal in the U.S. as it is in Britain, but we do have a history of telling ghost stories at Christmas, most notably Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Right. Okay, so today we are going to discuss the old tradition of telling spooky tales on Christmas night.
I'm Elizabeth.
And I'm Sarah.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
So on first blush, it may seem strange to tell ghost stories at Christmas time. Our current Christmas or holiday period, whether it be Kwanzaa or Hanukkah or Christmas or whatever, they're mostly happy celebrations that focus largely around children, especially the consumerism part of the holidays, the massive amount of retail sales, the huge amount of toys that are produced and bought during the season, and even the colors that have become synonymous with the holidays. Bright and vibrant red and green, bright blue and silver. These are all happy and energetic colors. They're kind of energetic and boisterous.
But these holiday celebrations are also happening during the deepest part of the winter months. The days are as short as they'll ever be all year. The sun is not out a lot. It's cold. It's snowing, or at least theoretically, depending on where you live. So typically, this is the period of the year when people kind of hunker down around a fire. It's a little bit of a scary time because it's so dark outside. I mean, geez, I get off work at 5 o'clock and it's almost pitch black when I'm walking to my car, right? So, you know, people are feeling a little cold, a little sad, both literally with sad. Was it like seasonal depressive disorder?
Yeah.
Disorder.
There you go. Because they're not getting a lot of vitamin D, but they're also feeling introspective. Mm-hmm, and so this dark part of the year was when people thought about their dead, about their ancestors, as well as getting a little scared or freaked out by the darkness outside of their homes.
Mm. Historically, before the advent of artificial lighting and heating, the winter months were a dangerous time. People would spend all of the fall harvesting crops and slaughtering animals so that they would have enough to last them throughout the winter. But the winter could also be a time for celebration, specifically around the winter solstice, which was and is viewed as the turning point in the year, where the sun will now be coming back. In pre-Christian Scandinavia, the Feast of Jule, or Yule, lasted for 12 days and celebrated the rebirth of the sun. It also gave rise to the custom of burning a Yule log. Not a log. I don't have a log.
It's the log. It's
wait,
log.
Nobody got that reference to Christmas, the Christmas Vacation?
No.
No.
What the fuck? you guys.
And I like Where know like, that movie too.
It's
like,
what do you think? It's doing? A Yule log, not a log. I don't have a log. Sorry.
Where's the Tylenol?
Hey, Ross.
Holy shit.
Oh, Lord.
Okay. I could go on forever and ever and ever. In ancient Rome, the winter solstice was celebrated by the Feast of Saturnalia to honor Saturn, the god of agricultural bounty, and was characterized by feasting, debauchery, and gift-giving. I'm just going to interject here to say that my Latin teacher, when I was in high school, taught us that, you know how we say Merry Christmas at Christmas time, or there's like greetings that you associate with different holidays?
Yeah.
The greeting associated with Saturnalia was, Yo, Saturnalia. He could have made that up, but random. I choose to believe that it's true. With Emperor Constantine's conversion to Christianity, many of these customs were later absorbed into Christmas celebrations.
In Britain, the celebrations surrounding Christmas declined in the mid-1600s, courtesy of the Puritans.
Ruin everything.
Who were troubled both by the rowdy nature of the holiday festivities and by the perceived association of those festivities with the old Catholic faith. Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector of England in the 17th century, was a Puritan, and Cromwell wanted to get rid of all the holidays' decadent excess. John Taylor, a royalist, so somebody who supported Charles I during the English Civil War, not Cromwell. So Taylor wrote that, quote, of all the harmless sports which people had long celebrated Christ's nativity are now extinct and put out of use, as if they had never been, and thus are the merry lords of misrule suppressed by the mad lords of bad rule at Westminster.
Cromwell's banning of Christmas, or should we say war on Christmas, didn't stick around too long, though. Many Englishmen and women continued to practice their traditional Christmas customs, even though things like Christmas carols were banned. There were even a lot of pro-Christmas riots occurring during the post-war period. In December 1646, for example, a group of young men at Bury St. Edmunds threatened local tradesmen who had opened their shops on Christmas Day, and the day ended in a pretty big and bloody fight. There were other riots in Norwich, Ipswich, London, and Canterbury, where crowds of protesters first smashed up shops that opened on Christmas Day. In Canterbury, the rioters took control of the entire city. Cromwell was installed as Lord Protector in 1653, and so the celebration of Christmas was banned until the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, and Old Christmas Day was finally brought back.
It's a really common theme for people, you know, the sort of Whiggish version of history is that the Protestant Reformation brought all of this rationality to religion, and instead of just doing random stuff because your priest told you to, you did things based on the Bible. And so, like, this all sounds positive and great and amazing. But there's also Max Weber, and he calls it the Protestant Reformation and the disenchantment of the world.
Okay.
It says that the Protestant Reformation amounted to the loss of magic in everyday life. So it's a desacralization. Mm-hmm. Like, and people felt empty and sad,
yes,
and like, oh, now I'm just sitting on this, you know, pew and this, like, you know, this thing with white walls, and, you know, my life has lost all of its magic.
Mm.
And then that becomes a problem later. Not a problem, but it becomes, in the 19th century, there are these, like, little revivals of, like, spiritualism and things in the 18th and 19th centuries.
People looking for more, yeah.
Right. So that whole thing is part of it.
Yeah.
Instead of having feast days and having, you know, having these things where you had fun, at churches, the priests used to, they used to brew ale, and you would go and have like an ale day or whatever. And that all ended, obviously. Yeah. So their main source of community and fun is gone.
And it explains why people would riot.
Yeah. And
right.
It's not just something silly about getting mad over Starbucks cup, right?
Right.
No, like, it's not like that.
Like, fundamental human needs.
Right.
Yeah.
Being sucked out of your life.
Yeah. Because the Puritans really ushered in sort of a bleak and dark view of humanity and the world in general. And so to not have that broken up with festivals. And I just want to say, too, that this is actually something that a lot of Protestants today are grappling with, which I think is interesting that it continues to be something that people talk about, that the, you know, we feel a great indebtedness to the Reformation, but we also a lot of Protestants today are actually hearkening back even further to Orthodox sort of mysticism because they, even now, they want something more. They want something kind of deeper and more mysterious than they're getting out of sort of mainline Protestantism.
Right. And they want the ritual, which is something that is missing. Because ritual is considered to be superstitious.
Yeah.
But they want, the Catholic Church has never gotten rid of their rituals.
Mm-hmm.
They
have for a reason. Rituals. Yeah.
Right.
And so I've actually heard things about people leaving, say, evangelical churches because they find them too domineering, claustrophobic, right? Like they don't fit with their worldview, but then going to Catholic churches or Anglican churches because what they want is that sense of mystery and ritual. Yeah, it gives them something that they didn't get. So you'd think that you'd leave a very kind of strict religious practice and go to a very liberal religious practice, but they don't. A lot of people go into the Catholic Church or into similar churches that have a lot of ritual because it kind of feeds a need that they have. So it's interesting how we still, you think of the Puritans as being, you know, kind of so long ago, and we've moved past that. In a lot of ways that it still affects even how people relate to faith today.
There is still a tension between Protestant and Catholic and Episcopal, which is what the Anglicans are called here.
Right. I can never remember, so I was just saying Anglican.
Yeah, it's Episcopal. There's still a lot of tension between those ways of life. And a lot of it does involve that ritual.
And even older, even going back into the kind of an Orthodox Eastern sort of faith, a lot of modern day Protestants are kind of even pushing back past the Catholics, right, and going for something even older.
Right, to the early church.
Uh-huh, exactly, yeah. I don't know anything about this. I just find it all very, very interesting. So I sound like an idiot when I talk about it. Okay.
So I sound like an idiot.
All right. So back to this idea about Christmas happening during the darkest, dreariest time of the year. It makes sense that ghosts and spirits would be part of that. I mean, it's just kind of a creepy time, you know?
Right.
That's like my totally scientific historian way of saying that, right? But this led to a tradition of telling ghost stories around the Yule log, or around the winter fire. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence that these, you know, winter stories were part and parcel of the Christmas season. For example, British literary critic Catherine Belzy points out that, quote, among the terms in circulation in the period for far-fetched narratives and improbable fables, one favorite was a winter's tale. So in the long, cold evenings when the soil had been tilled to the extent that climatic conditions permitted, the still predominantly agricultural community of early modern England would sit and while away the hours of darkness with fireside pastimes, among them old wives' tales designed to enthrall young and old alike.
For example, in Christopher Marlowe's 1589 play, The Jew of Malta, the character Barnabas says, "Now I remember those old women's words who in my wealth would tell me winter's tales and speak of spirits and ghosts that glide by night." And there's Shakespeare's play, The Winter's Tale, in which Shakespeare even has one of the characters, Prince Mamilius, make the title's meaning clear by proposing to tell the court a story. A sad tale's best for winter. I have one of sprites and goblins.
So ghost stories have been associated with Christmas long before Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol. Yet to many Christmas revelers, A Christmas Carol has become synonymous with Christmas. It's like the Christmas story, right? You know, you go see the Nutcracker, you watch one of the gazillion renditions of A Christmas Carol on TV, you put some cookies out for Santa at night, and you watch A Christmas Story with Ralphie and the Red Ryder BB gun on repeat all day until football starts.
And then you watch It's a Wonderful Life, or I come to your house and I punch you in the head.
Exactly, right. So, I mean, obviously that's a very kind of white secular American Christmas that I've just described there, and not everyone's practices, you know, that way, but a lot of Americans in particular could at least pick probably one of those things out of that list and agree that that happens to some extent in their house during the holidays. But the gist is here that A Christmas Carol is part of that. So what I find really interesting is that A Christmas Carol was actually a kind of sentimentalized longing for a time that had long passed.
That's actually really fascinating, because we like, or at least me in particular, I also, it's part of my ritual of Christmas movies that I watch is the new version with Patrick Stewart. It's the best version.
I have not seen that one.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. So good. But we enjoy that movie, or the story of A Christmas Carol, because it is a sentimentalized story of the long past. Well, and it itself was a story of the sentimentalized long past. Yes. So. And just in case there is someone out there who needs their memory jogged, that one person out there who is unfamiliar, here's a quick synopsis of A Christmas Carol. It was written in 1843 by Charles Dickens, and it's about the spiritual conversion of the old miser Ebenezer Scrooge. At first, of course, Scrooge scoffs at the idea of Christmas with a bah humbug. After the appearance of the ghost of his former, now deceased, obviously, stingy partner, Jacob Marley, and the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, Scrooge reforms and offers to help the disabled little boy, Tiny Tim, son of his clerk, Bob Cratchit. Yeah. Charles Dickens wrote, "How many old recollections and sympathies does Christmas time awaken?" For Dickens, Christmas was a time of looking back. It's almost a sad sort of longing, a simpler time gone by, an idealized Christmas of the recent past. In the Pickwick Papers, he describes a good-humored Christmas in which, after Blind Man's Bluff, there was a great game at Snapdragon, and when fingers enough were burned with that and all the raisins were gone, they sat down by the huge fire of blazing logs to a substantial supper and a mighty bowl of wassail. And so, in a way, through the ghost story of A Christmas Carol, Dickens actually helped to create a new kind of Christmas during the Victorian era.
Right. So A Christmas Carol, like you said, was printed in 1843. So by that time, the Industrial Revolution was changing the way that Britons lived their day-to-day lives. Wage labor was taking over. People were no longer working in accordance to the rise and fall of the sun or the change of the seasons. They were now slaves to the clock. I mean, this is literally when clocks started to be used, right? People started carrying pocket watches, right? So they were slaves to this clock, working at the whim of somebody else. The Industrial Revolution meant fewer days off for everyone. And Christmas was in many respects just another work day. Now, remember, this is before weekends meant, you know, weekdays off. This is before labor unions, although we are getting back to that real quick right now. And so you can see that personified in Dickens' character from A Christmas Carol, Bob Cratchit. He's forced to work on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve by his miserly boss, Ebenezer Scrooge.
And there's even some discussion over whether he'll get any time off for Christmas Day. Right. Like he can have a couple of hours or something. Right. Yeah. Dickens perceived a kind of social harmony in old Christmas, in the Christmas of his childhood. The old Christmas had been more of a community festival, an expression in the idle period of the agricultural year of charity in its older sense of fellowship. And you can see that nostalgia in Dickens' Ghost of Christmas Past. Mr. Fezziwig's ball, held by Fezziwig for all of those people who worked for him, looks back towards this festivity that would happen within the manor or farmhouse in which villagers and people who worked for an employer, and as well as all of their family, came to sort of a huge, what was essentially an office party, right?
Yeah.
Social harmony was the vision he saw Christmas representing. And the 18th century Christmas that Dickens drew on was a rosy image of pre-industrial society.
But in that nostalgia, Dickens created a new Christmas. And this new Christmas that he helped create was essentially a private and family affair, one that centered around children and family. British historian Mark Connolly wrote, quote, "However important, though he undoubtedly was, Dickens did not create Christmas. Rather, he reflected a general early 19th century interest in the season and was part of a widespread, particularly middle class, desire to reinvigorate its ancient customs." Dickens was part of a broader movement during the mid-19th century to make sense of the changing, industrializing world. The Victorians built their new Christmas out of a nostalgia for an ideal 18th century countryside. So Dickens didn't create this, but he was part of a larger movement that was kind of getting nostalgic, right?
About
old times. And I think we can all relate to that. Yeah. I mean, that there's a nostalgia now, like for the 1950s, right?
Exactly.
Which is the nostalgia that we have for it is not what was actually reality, right? So it's the same kind of thing going on.
Absolutely. A Christmas Carol was something that captured the feeling of the 19th century public by stressing fellowship, empathy between different sections of society, and the responsibility of employers and good cheer. Things that people felt were being laid by the wayside. And I think this helps explain why this story is still so very popular, because these are issues that modern society still has to deal with.
Right. So Dickens tapped into an underlying feeling going on during the Industrial Revolution. In almost all of his writings, he offered relentless social commentary on the plight of the poor and underprivileged of his time, and on the insensitivity and hypocrisy of the privileged classes.
And within this desire to bring family, hearth, and home to the center of the season, certain traditions that we recognize today came to fruition. For example, Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, is popularly associated with institutionalizing the British family Christmas. He brought the Tannenbaum, or Christmas tree, from his native Germany in 1841. The Christmas tree replaced the traditional British Yule log, wood designed to give winter warmth, and replaced it with a tree to deck with lights, favors, and presents. I like trees. I like the tree better than a log.
Yeah.
The log is so not, isn't it?
It's not.
It's not very.
It's big. It's what? It's wood.
Y'all know?
I do.
Stimpy? Yes. Okay.
James sings
better
that
than
all
bad.
The...
It's good.
James
Everyone
sings it all
the log. All right. A Christmas Carol, together with further four Christmas books published over the succeeding 5 years by Dickens, changed the course of Christmas publishing and so linked the festive season with Dickens in the minds of the reading public. Consequently, from 1850 to 1867, he produced Christmas stories for the magazines he edited, the popularity of which were reflected in sales towards the end of that time of nearly 300,000. A Christmas Carol is the most filmed of Dickens' books, as well as being produced for stage, radio, and audio recordings.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
After Dickens' death, A Christmas Carol turned into an industry and grew steadily with lantern slideshows, plays, musicals, operas, chamber music, recordings, radio productions, and films. Some of the best-known film versions featured stars like Vincent Price, Basil Rathbone, Patrick Stewart, and Mickey Mouse. Although these films were later adapted for television, small local television productions began in 1943. 2 years later, NBC telecast a takeoff called The Strange Christmas Dinner. That sounds so weird. Animated features like Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol were first broadcast around 1962.
So what's your favorite? Your favorite one's the Patrick Stewart one?
Well, yes and no. I remember watching one of the... I can't think of the name of the guy who was in it. But there was an older version from, like, I want to say, like, the 50s or 60s.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
That's real famous, and yeah. I can't think of what it's called. But my parents, they loved that version, and we would watch it sometimes when I was little, but it scared me.
Yeah.
It was really scary. But, yeah, my favorite now is, well, I have two. My favorite is the Patrick Stewart version.
Better be Muppets number two.
Muppets is number two.
Yeah.
The Muppet, Muppet Christmas Carol has a really... Yes. Special place in my heart. That's the movie that my family watches on Christmas night.
Yes. Yes. Mine is number one, Scrooged. We don't go a Christmas without watching Scrooge.
I've never seen it.
That's Bill Murray, dude.
I've never seen it.
Oh my God, you have to watch it right
I've
now.
I've never seen it. I've also never seen Groundhog's Day, and everybody talks about
Scrooged. Yeah. Scrooged. Second one is Muppets.
Muppets.
Then the Disney one.
There's a Disney one?
Yes.
Like the Mickey?
Yeah. Scrooge McDuck?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, I love that one.
I don't know. I guess
Mickey's Christmas Carol.
70s or something.
I think it's early
80s.
Yeah. I love that one.
I had a record of it. So do you remember when you had those plastic record players and then the record would be like printed on the front? Did y'all have record players?
Nope.
Oh, you guys are so young. Well,
I had.
Okay. Yeah. And so I had the Disney like
Aww. Like Christmas Carol, Mickey's Christmas Carol on that record. And so I'd just play it in my room like over. And it was like a big Fisher Price record player. It's so cute.
That was the one that my dad used to tape the Christmas specials off of TV every year. And then we would rewatch them over and over and over again. So we had this one tape that was Mickey's Christmas Carol, the Claymation Christmas.
Yes.
All Wait, those are the best.
Which one? Like Rudolph?
No. It was called A Claymation Christmas.
Oh.
Huh. And it had the California Raisins in it.
Oh, my singing. God. Oh, yeah. I know exactly which one.
It's the best. I actually YouTube it every year and make my kids watch it. And they're like, what is this?
I'll have to show my children because they're gonna be so freaked out.
It's the dinosaurs going down the road. Here we come, a waffling. And they're eating waffles.
Oh, my God. I had forgotten about that one. That's awesome. Now we're going to... All right. So you guys on social media, let us know what your favorite a Christmas Carol rendition or just holiday movie is in general.
Dickens and A Christmas Carol have become a strong part of American pop culture. So many American cities have Dickens celebrations. Galveston, Texas is celebrating its 45th year of Dickens on the Strand, where everybody dresses up in Victorian garb and drinks hot cider and roasted nuts.
Even though sometimes it's 80 degrees.
I know, I can't imagine that. If you go to Disney World during the holidays, all of the actors are dressed up in Dickensian costumes. Rochester, even just down the road, has a Dickens festival. I mean, they're everywhere.
Scholar Susan Rossi Wilcox wrote a really fascinating article about the longevity of the Christmas pudding and how many of the foods that we eat for traditional Christmas dinner owe a lot to Charles Dickens' work and his descriptions of the food people ate in his stories. She goes on to write, quote, many of the foods that we associate with the elegant Christmas feast, such as plum pudding, are attributed to his writings, particularly A Christmas Carol. And she goes on to argue that the American public's fascination with their table seems to heighten around Christmas time, with annual performances of A Christmas Carol in elementary schools, readings to raise funds for nonprofit organizations, and films scheduled for television. Dickens fiction merges closely with all that is secular about the season. His work is associated with holiday food, drinks, smells, and nostalgia ad nauseum.
And something I didn't know, but internet searches for Christmas pudding or English pudding soar during the holidays. So somebody is making these things.
Have you guys ever had a pudding, a Christmas pudding?
No.
I don't know what
steamed pudding. I don't either.
It's like a traditional like plum pudding.
Yeah.
I've had a sticky toffee pudding before, but not at, actually I think I have had it at Christmas. My friend Rich makes them at his restaurant. And Rossi Wilcox argues that this is because people read about them in A Christmas Carol. Even that cookbook that probably everyone has or has at least seen, The Joy of Cooking, you know the one. It has red and white plaid or kind of gingham design.
It doesn't anymore? No, that Marissa
the
pointed
Betty
this
Crocker.
Out. Yes, and because that's the one I was thinking of. The Joy of Cooking is white and it has a circle on it.
Yes. But
this is the other.
So everybody's. My mom had the Betty Crocker.
Yeah. My mom, my grandma, I have it, the Betty Crocker one, but I know somebody had that Joy of Cooking one too.
I have the Joy of Cooking also.
You do. Okay. See, there we go.
Interesting. Okay.
Anyway.
Either way, you know what we're talking about.
It's called Better Home Cooking, the Betty Crocker one.
The red and white one.
Yes.
Yeah. But we're not talking about that one. We're talking about the other one.
Joy of Cooking.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
These books have editions spanning like three quarters of a century and is a quintessential American cookbook. And it includes steamed suet pudding and categorizes it as a truly festive Christmas dish that needs patience in the making. And it's in the revised 1960s edition all the way onward, which that sounds gross, by the way. In 1997, the process of steaming a pudding was so foreign to American readers that they had to put an expanded illustration to show people how to do this.
And I still, like, I don't, what? Steaming a pudding?
Yeah.
I mean, and they look like a bowling ball or something. Like, right. They look like a haggis or something almost. Like, there's...
Well, suet is fat.
Beef fat, yeah.
It's a bit gross. All right.
That's what my grandpa fed to his birds.
Yeah, I have suet feeder.
All right, so let's mosey on back to this thread about ghost stories.
movies. Yeah. So Ghost Stories at Christmas. So besides A Christmas Carol, ghost stories at Christmas time are a kind of a decidedly British thing.
Yeah.
Americans pretty much just have A Christmas Carol and that's it. But Britain has a stronger and more contemporary tradition of telling Christmas ghost stories. The long British history of broadcasting Christmas ghost stories has kept them part of the season since the BBC started broadcasting Christmas radio in 1923.
The BBC started broadcasting short ghost story television films in the 1970s, all under the label of A Ghost Story for Christmas. These ran each year from 1971 to 1978. The first five films were adaptations of ghost stories by M.R. James, who was a British medievalist scholar and writer of ghost stories during the early 20th century. The first five films are adaptations of stories from the four books by M.R. James, published between 1904 and 1925. Yeah. James actually became known for writing a new scary story for Christmas, inviting some of his friends and students into his rooms when he was the provost at Eton and King's College and reading his stories by candlelight. James's ghost stories aren't about Christmas like A Christmas Carol is. Instead, they harken back to the winter's tale and the tradition of telling ghostly stories during the time around the winter solstice.
The sixth film in that series, A Ghost Story for Christmas, was an adaptation based on a short story by Charles Dickens, The Signalman. And the series was wildly popular, right? I mean, ask kind of any film nut and they'll be like, oh, yeah, I know about A Ghost for Christmas. I know. I didn't know about it. But Jason was like, oh, yeah, I totally know about that.
Oh, anyway. Interesting.
So the series was actually revived in 2005 and 2006 on BBC Four. And there were new adaptations of stories by M.R. James. And they were broadcast along with repeats of old episodes from the original series. And just on the show notes, I've got some YouTube videos like go into these so you can see them. And oh my god, like the intro and stuff, like they're freaky. They're
oh, I want to watch.
Yeah,
them.
Like my kids are sitting next to me and they're like, what's that? And I was like, nothing. So yeah. The BBC also made two more adaptations of M.R. James' stories on Christmas Eve 2010. And finally, the Tractate Middoth, another story by M.R. James, was broadcast on BBC Two on Christmas Day 2013. This was also followed by a documentary, M.R. James, Ghostwriter. So, you know, check out the show notes and you can kind of see some of that stuff. So like we mentioned earlier, many of James's stories were first told to his pupils and students who adored him in front of a roaring fire in his study at the old Provost's Lodge at King's College. And this usually happened around Christmas time because that's when they had free time and there was plenty of eggnog to go around. M.R. James, he kind of, when thinking about this, it kind of makes me think of like Professor Slughorn in Harry Potter,
right?
Like, you
yes.
know, collecting all his favorite students
yes.
or whatever, right? Now, there are a few themes or components to James's ghost stories. One, there had to be a malevolent spirit. So these are not Dickens ghosts that ultimately serve a benevolent purpose, right? James's ghosts are mean. He wrote, "Must there be horror, you ask? I think so. You must have horror and also malevolence. Also, the stories had to be set in normal, everyday surroundings so that the reader can picture the story happening to her. It cannot be said too often that the more remote in time the ghost is, the harder it is to make him effective." So, you know, many of James's ghost stories are set kind of in the recent past, or at least his recent past, mm-hmm. right?
Again, not unlike Dickens' ghosts who take Ebenezer through his recent past, his present, and his soon-to-be future, right? So ghost stories at Christmas time bring up the feelings that this gloomy, spooky time of year entails. The ghosts of Christmas are our past, present, and future. They are our fears, our depressions, our loneliness, our missed opportunities that are just swirling around us all year, but they seem more acute during this deepest part of the winter. So just like the mixed feelings that we can have at Christmas time, we can be happy and celebrate friends and family and children's joy, but we can also be sad, right? We can miss loved ones. The supposed celebratory nature of the season can exacerbate depression and sadness. If we think about Christmas in that sense, telling ghost stories actually makes a lot of sense.
Right. So, and you can also think about it as something fun to do, like telling ghost stories around a campfire, right? It's fun. It's thrilling. It's a group activity, all emotions that heighten the fun and party atmosphere of Christmas. So Christmas ghost stories actually highlight this funny oxymoronic element of the holidays, yeah, right? This absolutely. Kind of happiness and sadness all in one.
Yeah. And I think that this is interesting that you... I had never heard of these M.R. James ghost specials yeah. that the BBC did, but it reminds me of anyone out there, and I'm sure we have some listeners who are Doctor Who fans. Since Doctor Who was revived in, I want to say 2005, forgive me, fans, for not knowing that off the top of my head, every year or... Well, every year there's a Christmas special, and the Christmas specials are really good at that, right? Mm-hmm. Doctor Who is kind of scary, but it's always kind of sad, and it's always funny. So they would have these Christmas specials that are sometimes that are almost always related. Like one year they had like killer snowmen, or mm-hmm. like I think one of the most recent ones there was like a like Santa Claus that came in and saved the day, but he was like. Kind of like a weird figure, you know, like a kind of an alien. And so it kind of captures all of these things. And they also use their Christmas specials to be the episodes usually where the doctor regenerates. So like an old doctor dies and then a new doctor is born. And it for fans, it's really emotional.
No, absolutely. And okay, you film people, forgive me if I get this wrong, but I think that some of the producers of these new retakes of mm-hmm. the M.R. James stories were actually also producers and directors of Doctor Who. So there's
that some, would make so much
and
sense.
And I'm remembering this off the top of my head, so I don't know. I don't have it in front of me right now, but mm-hmm. there is more of a connection. There's the cultural British connection.
Right.
And then I think also like some actual like producing connections as well.
Yeah, so, that makes so much sense. Yeah. I think that maybe this is kind of going out on a limb, but I wonder if maybe the British are better at recognizing the mix of feelings and emotions that Christmas can bring up than Americans are.
Probably. Americans are really shitty at doing emotions.
Yeah, we're bad at that. And so, but I think that they're acknowledging in their popular Christmas culture that it's a happy time of year, but it comes with all of this kind of sadness, right? Mm-hmm. Although
emotional baggage.
I say that, and some of our most famous Christmas songs get to that, right? I'll be home for Christmas, mm-hmm. if only in my dreams, right? That famous song of the World War II era. And then what's the one from Meet Me in St. Louis? That's really Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Oh, that's actually that really, really sad. You know, this might be the last time that we're all together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listeners. But you also have the Christmas shoes.
Which one is that?
Oh, that one is
sad. Sir, I gotta buy these shoes. Because his mom is dying. His mom is dying.
Country
and he's
music.
No, yeah. It's not country. It's not. It's just like maudlin Christian garbage.
I don't know that song.
His mom's gonna meet Jesus tonight. Oh, and he's gotta awful. Wear some beautiful shoes, but he doesn't have any money.
What about the
poor.
Christmas donkey?
Dominic the Christmas donkey. It's Dominic the donkey. I had never heard that song until I moved to Buffalo.
I had never heard. I was working in this office and they were playing Christmas music and I was sitting there. I was like, what the hell is this nonsense?
That one doesn't quite. Although it does get. It has an imagined past, right? Of like this Italian.
Yeah.
Made up something.
To see Jesus baby. Isn't that his whole thing?
Oh, no, wait. I think that's where the donkey comes from culturally, the idea of a donkey at Christmas time, which I think is an Italian thing. And I think that's why it's, but in the song, it says that they can't, the reindeer, which this doesn't make any sense at all. This doesn't make any sense at all. The reindeer can't navigate the mountains and hills of Italy, which isn't that exactly what a reindeer is for? Like, right? Like they're a winter. Mountainous, right. You know, polar region creature, but apparently the Italians need a donkey to do that.
Whoa, this got off the rails.
But I want to come back around to the idea of sort of mixing the happiness and sadness of Christmas. Because now when you really think about it, almost all of our favorite Christmas movies do that. Many of them. I mean, even I'm thinking of that really silly movie, Christmas with the Cranks.
Yep. Sure.
And even that has sort of like a, they have the sadness of letting go of having Christmases when their kid was little,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which makes me want to lay on the floor and cry.
I guess it's just the weirdness of, like, totally bringing in a ghost.
That's where
it's like, huh?
It's the ghost element of it yeah. that...
I think that's why Americans can associate with Dickens more than mm-hmm. M.R. James, right?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, that part of it speaks to us, but the actual scary yeah. part of it,
yeah,
having that be part of Christmas is, like, not American,
yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah.
But certainly
British.
But we
can make it American.
Yeah, we can Americanize
there
it.
There we go.
Mm-hmm.
We're on a mission.
Scrooged.
Well, and that's kind of what I was thinking. Okay, well, that's Scrooge. But again, it's
Scrooge
still...
Scrooge is creepy.
It is creepy. But it's Dickens, though.
You know what
I just realized? It's taking a miser and it's the ghosts are benevolent. They're not just there to be scary.
Which in Christmas Carol, they are
that's
scary.
That's what I'm...
Yeah.
But they're benevolent. And that's the difference between the Dickens ghost and the M.R. James's ghost. The M.R. James ghosts are malevolent.
Like they want to gouge
your eyeballs out, right?
One other insight that I just had.
Oh.
Ding. You're talking about Americanizing the idea of the Christmas ghost, right? I might argue mm-hmm. that Clarence in It's a Wonderful Life is the American version of a Christmas ghost, but he's an angel. Right? Because he still takes him through all of this ghost of Christmas past type stuff, mm-hmm. right? And he goes through all of his life.
But he doesn't want to kill him.
No, but neither does the ghost of Christmas present, right?
Well, that's the thing. That's Dickens, though.
Although
so it's
he
a
does,
benevolent
at the end,
ghost.
He is like, here's
so
your grave.
It's a Wonderful Life is just a ripoff
of
Dickens.
A Christmas Carol. Yes.
But in the most wonderful way.
Because every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings.
Aww. Zuzu. And with that, thank you for listening.
Yes. Thank you.
Follow us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. And then you can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can see a lot of our behind the scenes on Instagram and Pinterest. It's all at dig_history. Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Wait. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy
Christmahana Kwanzaa.
There you go. Happy solstice.
Happy
Just
everybody.
Love one another.
Do they know it's Christmas time at all?
Feed the world.
This podcast was produced by the historians of Dig, Elizabeth Garner Masaryk, Sarah Hanley Cousins, Marissa Rhodes, and me, April Earls. You can find show notes and further reading, as well as the archive for the History Buffs podcast at digpodcast.org. Thanks for listening.
Yet to many Christmas relivers of revelers?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Dickensian or
Dickensian?
I would say
Dickensian.
It is, really? I would always say Dickensian. Okay.
Dickensian?
Yeah.
There's no O in it, though.
It's Dickensian.
Oh,
anyway.
Oh, my gosh. Mr. Fezziwig's ball held by... Wait a second. Fezziwig. And Mom. In pre-Christian Scandinavia, the feast of Jule, or Yule.
What?
It reminded me of Zool.
Zool.
Yeah.
There was a best Halloween, family group at my Halloween party.
Yeah.
Somebody was Zool, somebody was a gatekeeper.
Oh my gosh.
And then their baby was a stick with marshmallow.
Aww.
That's awesome.
I love family Halloween costumes. Okay.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.